Wednesday, January the 17th, the day of the State of the Union, and always one of such tenseness for me, quite out of proportion to any responsibility I have for it. Lyndon spent much of the morning reading the supposed to be final draft, I think it was the 11th, the State of the Union. Liz was on hand. He told me to get her, and I think she helped him some. There was quite a little while when I did not see him, and I think he was in the theater. Lyndon had asked George to draft him a statement based on what he had said to him, announcing that he would not run. I believe it was around noon when he brought it in, his face calm, unrevealing, as it always is. It was a good statement, well said. My own, which Lyndon had asked me to produce, was feeble, and if there was anything that we ever ought to say, words that have wings and fire, this is it. I keep the statement I had written in August of 64, when Lyndon was facing going to Atlantic City and did not want to go, in the right-hand drawer of my desk in my bedroom. I brought it out, and we reread what I had said then, and George read it. It sounds better now. Lyndon put George's statement in his inside pocket. It was not to be included in the text of the State of the Union. If he made it, it would come at the end, beginning with a line something like this. And now I want to speak to you about a personal matter. He looks from one to another of those close to him for an answer, for some wisdom, some foresight beyond any he can have. There isn't any. There's nobody but him. Sometime I had lunch on a tray, and then there was a happy break. Brooke Astor and Lawrence Rockefeller had flown down from New York for the beautification meeting, and I drove with them, Henry Diamond and Sharon, out to Buchanan School. We'd planned it just the afternoon before, and this morning I had told Liz to be sure and cue in the principal of the school, some of the children if they wanted, and the press. We arrived about 1:15. Brooke and I had put on boots. There was Mrs. White, the principal, the construction chief, an orderly but excited group of youngsters, fifth and sixth graders I think they were, who had painted the panels that surround the construction. The bright, primitive, funny scenes of a child's interpretation of what's taking place there. We walked all over, Brooke and Lawrence and Mrs. White and the construction chief and I. Actually, at this midpoint, it's mostly a great gaping mud hole, but you can see it taking shape, and it's exciting. There's the sunken basketball court, the seats or bleachers rising on each side, and the spray equipment so that in the summertime, little children can romp in the cooling spray, and it will be a good setting for all sort of dual-purpose things, like folk singing and plays and concerts, or maybe a dance. Then there was the igloo, which is one of Brooke's special enthusiasms, like she has in Carter, I think, or Jacob Riis. They'd even hauled in one tree, about a 30-foot red oak, I would think, and the chief of construction described to us where the trees would be and what the finished product would look like. At this point, Brooke interspersed and said, "We just must have flowers, raised flower beds. Why not here?" And she pointed them out on the plans. She said, "I know you love flowers, and I want us to have flowers." We were all talking at once, getting excited. It was really a delicious half hour. The long pergola-type effect, housing the restrooms, which can also be used for dressing rooms if they do have plays, the concession for light refreshments, and the office of any recreation director, stretch across one end. The whole effect is to be a combination school playground during school hours and a community center after school hours and in the summertime. And then we went over by the fence and met a lot of the children and looked at the panels, but this was the part of it that got shortchanged, and this was the best part. If we were to tell the story to the city through pictures, TV, that this is a good constructive addition to the schools and to the recreation life of Washington. But Cynthia and Sharon were telling me, "It's 2:00, we've got to go. All the committee members will be there." So back we went to the White House and upstairs to take off boots, and then down once more to the Red Room for the first meeting of 68, beginning our fourth, and will it be our last, year of the Beautification Committee. We had a good attendance. Besides Brooke and Lawrence, with Stew and Lowell Bridwell, and Kay Graham, Rudy Kaufman of the Star, Richard Hollander of the News, Katie Nat Owens, Mrs. Romig of the Garden Clubs, Libby, Adam Numishoski of the API, Bill Schmidt of the GSA, Polly, Walter. a lot of our observers, Diana and John Walker and Charlie Horsky, of course, Henry Diamond and Nash Castro. Bill Walton came in late from his commission's monthly meeting, and we missed, most of all, Mary. Whatever the date, it always seems to me to be the beginning of the new year when we return to Washington, especially when the State of the Union takes place. So I greeted them with a Happy New Year, everybody, and the suggestion that now in January was the time to look back on what we had done last year, for the last 3 years, in fact, and forward what we ought to do with this year before us. For that reason, I'd like for everybody to speak their piece. What do they think ought to be our aims? Where should we put our energy, our usefulness, if any, and our money? And then I told them the happy news that Mrs. Post, since the last meeting, had sent us a check for $10,000 to be used for street trees. Then I reminded them that it was only a year ago that Stephen Currier had been with us, had started Larry Halprin on a series of suggestions of what would lift the face of Washington. One of his suggestions had been a big amusement park by the water in Anacostia. Since then, a committee, Udall, Mayor Washington, and Larry had worked further on how to implement that. I asked you to report. The report was full of the opportunities, the potential, but nothing really conclusive. But when we got on trees, we got more steam up. Somebody made the suggestion, let's have a tree committee, made Libby Rowe chairman of it, talked of trying to use Arbor Day as a vehicle to get more interest and more contributions spread over a wider base from people who might contribute $5 rather than $5,000. From all these Washington citizens who love these tree-shaded streets, I came out loud and strong for one more trash pickup a week, if ever the budget could afford it, and for more trash containers, although I felt cruel even mentioning it when I looked at Walter, because he looked practically pale. We talked about our work with the schools. I had given a brief and enthusiastic summary of our visit to Buchanan, and the hope that in May we could have a real dedication celebration there. But the urgent need was to get a closer working relation with the new head of the Washington school system, to cue him in on everything we were doing. I asked Polly to have some preliminary meetings with Mr. Manning, or whoever else he thought might be helpful, and then possibly I could get together with him here at the White House for any plans that might further our usefulness with the schools. We talked for about 2 hours while the butlers passed coffee and cookies. It was a rather good meeting. Then, back upstairs, I worked with Ashton, rested, reviewed tonight, talked with Linda. I knew that Linda was meeting the Democratic leaders and the Republican leaders by turns, probably in the fish room. I seldom interrupt meetings like that, but I had this memo in my keeping, and I held it like a coal of fire, a statement from George Christian saying he was not going to run again, and I wanted to get it back in his pocket. So I took it over. I think it was about 6:30. He was rushed, standing in the door between the big Oval Office, his little one, and he said, "Well, what do you think? What shall I do?" I looked at him with that hopeless feeling and said, "Lucy hopes you won't run. She wants you for herself and Lynn and all of us being together. She does not want to give you up. Linda hopes you will run." This she had told me this afternoon with a sort of terrible earnestness, because her husband is going to war and she thinks there'll be more chance of getting him back alive and everything settled if you're president. Me, I don't know. I've said it all before. I can't tell you what to do. It was hardly a conversation. It was just a few phrases, with the sense always that the fish room was full of important congressional leaders waiting for him, and that there was Secret Service and assistance just, I hope, out of earshot through the door. I've said it so often, it was not the will or the setting to say it again. One, either you make a conscious decision to run in the same state of mind that a man who's becoming a monk or some such, just giving up your life, saying, "Here it is, I'll take whatever happens, I'll try to do some pacing and have some humor, even some fun, but I recognize it's not mine for the next 5 years." Or, two, simply make the announcement at a time and in words that only you can choose, but as strong and as beautiful as we're capable of. He handed me a piece of paper. It was from John Conley, his recommendations that he go with the statement tonight because we'd never have a bigger audience, and he thought the reaction to the bigger audience would be good rather than interpreted by the press. He thought this removed it, from a political context, and as we all know, is on a bit of an upward slope now. I think what John really meant was that this was a noble time to do it. I went back to the second floor. Mr. Pear gave me a comb out. I put on my red suit with a navy trim by Gerald Simpson. Linda was wearing the lovely navy blue dress with the white that her daddy had given her for Christmas. I studied the description of my guests of the evening for the last time and went over the seating chart. Then, a few minutes past 8, I went down to the library. Choosing the guests for the State of the Union is always an important thing. This time, it had been Liz's suggestion, and I had bought it, to try to honor, to highlight, some of the programs of Lyndon's administration into which he has put so much. We'd done some investigating by phone, and then I'd ask her to go and see the suggestions herself and evaluate them. I did not want to arrive at this in a haphazard, unthought-out fashion. It turned out to be a thrilling experience. There they were in the library. Sarah Beth Walker, a 24-year-old Oklahoman, a Vista worker, was actually working in Head Start, helping get volunteers. Susan Helmuth, of some little town in New York, who's a member of Teacher Corps, working in the Washington schools, teaching remedial reading. And Paul Milner, 17, from the Job Corps Center in Washington, whose high IQ has caused him to be selected out of Job Corps as a possible college potential. They were fresh and scrubbed and wholesome looking. And then there was Specialist Lawrence Joel, stocky, middle-aged, smiling Negro from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, who had received the Medal of Honor from Lyndon in one of the most touching citations I'd ever read. He was a medic, and although twice wounded, he had gone on and on and on to save life after life, crawling across the battlefield with his plasma and his medicines. They were all so easy to talk to. I was famished. I hadn't had anything to eat, scarcely all day, and I fell too on the sandwiches and the coffee, but I could hardly get them to eat a thing, which was all right because mostly I wanted them to talk, and they did. They were all in their different ways reassuring. Lawrence Joel, so natural, so at peace with himself and the world, and at ease. It was somehow a refreshing moment. Betty Furness came in. She was another guest of the evening. And Lyndon, briefly, and shook hands with all of them. And then we were in the cars and off once more to the Capitol. This time we had planned my entrance better than last. We went straight up to a little room. I had tried to describe on the route up to the youngsters what a dramatic evening it was, how the House and Senate would already be in their seats when we got there. And then, with a loud booming announcement, the diplomatic corps would walk in, and then the President's cabinet, and finally, the President. My guests were taken in, two by two, to their seats. And then, with precision, at the planned moment, Linda and Chuck and I, they had just joined us in the little room, walked in. I paused and stood for a moment as the senators and congressmen rose to their feet with a swelling roar of applause. And I know it's just part of the drama, part of the excitement of being back. But I savored it, and I looked from one side of the chamber to the other into the faces of many friends, smiled all around, and then we took our seats. There we were on the front row. Walter Washington, I had particularly wanted to ask him and Bonetta. And next to them, the golden blonde Susan Helmuth, the Teachers Corps, and then Specialist Joel, loaded with medals, and Chuck in his uniform, very handsome. Linda, her hair piled high on her head, white bow and buttons, a good foil for her slim navy Jeffrey Bean dress. And I, next to me on the step seat, cute little Sarah Beth Walker, and Paul Milner, sitting right by Muriel, who looked lovely in a pink satin suit. I'd used my other step seats for Betty Furness and some of the staff members' wives who had worked so hard on the speech, Clay MacPherson, cute little Trudy Califano, and my always admired Elspeth Rostow. And then on the two folding seats in the back, George Christian's elderly mother and Sam Houston, who had come laboriously hobbling in and no doubt enjoyed it as much as anybody in the chamber. Fishbait Miller announced the President of the United States, and Lyndon came in to a thundering applause, a different atmosphere somehow from last year. It lasted 3 minutes. He looked wonderful. 15 or more pounds he's lost shows, and all to the good. And I like his hair growing longer just a little bit and not slicked down anymore. Speech, and there were changes even from the 11th draft of it.
one
lasted 49 minutes
for about 50 applauses.
By all odds, the most spontaneous and loudest one was when he said, "The American people have had enough of rising crime and lawlessness." One of the changes was an insertion on conservation, about continuing to work for highway beautification. I would not have sought it for the world, and I appreciated it. Somewhere in it, the teleprompter went out. I could tell, although I am not sure many people in the audience could, because he handled it beautifully. I could see him leafing through three or four pages of the text in front of him while he interpolated. Mostly, I thought it was magnificently done. A time or two, he added a few adjectives that I would have left off. I liked the spare bones better. As we approached the end, I tightened up in my seat. Would he reach in his pocket? Did I want him to? Would I be relieved if he did or if he didn't? It ended on a strong, high note, and there was a great roar of applause, and he did not reach in his pocket for the draft that I knew was there. He turned and walked down the steps. In a moment or two, I rose to follow, waving hello at the cabinet wives seated as I went, and then, out in the hall, said goodbye to Specialist Joel and Susan Helmuth and Sarah Beth Walker, Paul Milner, and then for the ritual visit to the speaker's office. And here is where I began to wonder if I had been off the beam. I had felt a surge in the chamber. I had listened to a roar of applause. But here, with the cabinet members, with the leadership, was no rush forward to say, "That was a great speech, Mr. President. We'll get to work on it. It's going to be hard, but it'll be a good year." The first little maggots of doubt began to erode the good feeling I'd had, and then we were back in the car and headed for the White House. As many of us as could pile in, I rode with Lyndon. And upstairs on the second floor, we began to assemble. I'd ask close friends to drop by for drinks and a buffet and the TV shows and the general rehash that always takes place after a State of the Union. With Bob and Jean Kintner, of course, the MacPhersons and the Califanos, Doug and Libby Cater and the Rostows, the Bob Flennings and Marvin and Marion and Jack and Mary Margaret, George and Joanne, the Levinsons and the Temples, the Goldsteins and the Wattenbergs and the Hardesties, Barefoot Sanders and Mike Manitos, fresh from their flocks, and Liz and Bess and Ashton with their husbands, and Jim Kane, who's a house guest, and Sam Houston, Bill and Jeannie Beeson, and Bill and June White, Clark and Marnie, Reardon's, the Becks, the McHughes, Abe and Carol, briefly, Charlie Schultz, who must be the happiest man in town, and Marie and John Criswell. It was a good buffet in the dining room.
Right.
I settled down to drink in my bedroom, which was the only place where we could get the NET show, and indeed it was a lively one. The room was full. About 15 of us were in there watching it, and there was help from unexpected quarters. By Shower and Moynihan, and the most amusing remarks by Buckley. Bill Moyer spoke, and rather well, I thought. And Arthur Schlesinger was so bitter, I thought he was funny. Somebody said, "He looks like he's being milked." If so, the product must have been gall. Negro Mayor Carl Stokes was, I thought, reasonable and articulate, and mostly fair, I thought. Well, of course, there's never enough money for urban affairs, with mayors who need it. All in all, it was a highly amusing and entertaining program, and I thought we won more than we lost. Lyndon, in his bedroom, was busy looking at other programs with a few. The hall was full, and people drifted into the dining room for plates. I had a fire lit in the yellow room
for anyone
who wanted comfort and quiet conversation. It was an air of elation, goodwill, relief, a brief, short draft of the same sort of wine of success which we'd tasted in 64 and 65. So I evaluated it. Sometime after 12, everyone drifted off, and we were in bed by 1.